You're listening to the Tom Hartmann Program.
Well, and good Friday to you, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. It is Friday, so it is time for Brunch with Bernie, our national town hall meeting. Senator Bernie Sanders, the guy I think of as America's senator, although, as I've said many times, having been a Vermonter myself, I guess it's still in my blood, the people of Vermont are very proud to claim him as their senator. Sanders.senate.gov is his website. Bernie, welcome.
Good to be with you, Tom.
Great to have you. There's a lot going on. The jobs report came out today as a starting point.
And I think what's important to understand is the 120,000 or so jobs that were created is not by any means as much as we need or as many had hoped. But compared to where we were when Bush was president, it is a step forward, but tells me and should tell everybody that we have got to do a lot more. Let's never forget, as our Republican friends would like us to forget, that at the end of Bush's administration, we were losing over 700,000 jobs a month. That in the last quarter of the Bush administration, our GDP declined by just an incredible 6%. Whoa. And that at the end of the 8 years of Bush, there were over 500,000 private sector jobs lost. That was the economic record. So the point is, we are making some progress, but nowhere near enough. We got to turn the switch and become extremely aggressive in terms of jobs creation, and there's a lot that we can be doing. And one of the issues that bothers me very, very much is we just recently passed a transportation bill. This is what Congress does all of the time, has always done. You got to put money into roads and bridges and mass transit. We got to rebuild our crumbling infrastructure. And when you do this, you create and save millions of jobs. We passed it, interestingly enough, in a bipartisan manner in the Senate, 74 votes. I think half the Republicans were on board. But in the right-wing Republican House, they can't do it. So it's not only delaying the need to rebuild our crumbling infrastructure, it's the need to start creating jobs doing that. And in truth, we've got to do a lot more for infrastructure than that bill begins to do.
Yeah.
But we can't even get that done.
We've got a $2 trillion infrastructure deficit, and that's the 20th century infrastructure. We haven't even started on smart grids and high-speed rail, 21st
century
stuff.
Absolutely correct. We are. I mean, people go to China, and they come back, and they're riding on high-speed rail in China. They see internet service all over the country, broadband, cell phone service. And in this country, we are spending about one-quarter of our GDP as compared to the Chinese in infrastructure. So it makes no sense to me that we're not rebuilding our infrastructure, putting people to work, improving the productivity of our country, making us more internationally competitive. But so the news that we have today is not good. We want to do a lot better, but people can never forget that these trickle-down economic theories advocated by our Republican friends who are running for president, Mitt Romney and the rest, that's exactly what Bush was talking about. We saw that movie. Giving tax breaks to the rich does not create jobs. Providing huge corporate loopholes so that companies making billions of dollars a year in profit and end up not paying a nickel in federal income taxes does not create jobs. So we saw that movie before. It was a bad movie. We don't want to go back. What we need to do is put people to work rebuilding our infrastructure. We need to transform our energy system. I'm going to be sponsoring a conference here in Vermont on Monday, and we're going to be talking about how we significantly increase weatherization efforts, help people save money on their fuel bills in their homes, in their buildings, how we do it in schools, how we move rapidly to sustainable energy. And when we do those things, we not only cut greenhouse gas emissions, which is absolutely imperative, but we also save people money on their fuel bills, and we create a decent number of jobs. So we got to focus on transforming our energy system away from fossil fuel. And last but certainly not least, if we're talking about real job creation, we have got to finally deal with our disastrous trade policies, which make it so easy for large corporations to shut down in America, move to China, move to Vietnam, move to Mexico, and pay desperate workers in developing countries wages far, far below where the American wage level is. So those are some of the things we have to do. But at the end of the day, it's not just that unemployment is 8.2%. The truth is that when you include people who have given up looking for work, when you include people who work in part-time who want to work full-time, when you throw in the reality that millions and millions of workers have seen a decline in their real wages, they're working longer hours for low wages, you come to the realization that this country faces severe, severe economic problems. There was a study, Tom, I don't know if you happened to see it, came out, a couple of economists pointed out, when we talk about inequality in America, a point that I've been making is that in a recent 25-year period, some 80% of all new income went to the top 1%.
Yes.
What they indicated is that between 2010 and 2009, all of the new income created, in 2010, 93% of the new income went to the top 1%. 93%.
Right. That's our new economy.
Yeah, and 7% went to the bottom 99%. So the rich get much richer. You got 400 individuals in this country who own more wealth than the bottom half of America, 150 million people. And they don't just put that money under the mattress. They are using it politically, and Citizens United has opened the door for these billionaires to now significantly influence the political process. We're seeing that in the Republican primaries with billionaires contributing all kinds of money into Republican candidates. We're seeing it in money coming into Ohio. My friend Sherrod Brown is running for a re-election in Ohio, pouring millions of dollars into that state, in other states as well. So we have got to also not only create jobs that pay people a living wage, we have got to deal with the absurd income and wealth inequality in America by which so few have so much and so many have so little.
The gas, and meanwhile, gas prices are going up.
And then in the midst of all of this, you know, you sit here and you think about gas prices. And let me just, you know, reiterate what I've said on the show before. Many people think that, oh, well, gas prices are going up must mean that there is a an increase in demand and a diminishment in supply. Because that's what conventional economic theory is about. When you have prices go up, when you have more demand and less supply. The reality is, in fact, just the opposite. Right now, you have more supply in this country than we had in terms of gasoline than we had 3 years ago when the price of gas at the pump was $1.94 a gallon. In terms of demand, less demand for a variety of reasons. Recession, cars getting more miles to the gallon than we had since 1997, as I recall. So demand is down, supply is up, and the price of gas is going off the roof. And that, in my view, in the view of many other people, has a lot to do with our friends on Wall Street who are not content having destroyed the economy through their greed. They're now driving prices up by their control of the oil futures market.
Absolutely. Senator Bernie Sanders is with us. He'll be taking your calls for the rest of the hour. 866-987-THOM is our telephone number. Our Brunch with Bernie hour here on the Tom Hartman Program. 15 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And check out Bernie's website, sanders.senate.gov. You can sign his constitutional amendment to roll back Citizens United. You can sign up for his newsletter, the Bernie Buzz.
We increase more steeply the taxes paid by individuals in the highest brackets of all, incomes of $1 million a year and up. Wasn't that the American thing to do?
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, occupying the media 3 hours a day, 5 days a week. Senator Bernie Sanders on the line with us. It's our Brunch with Bernie hour. And Jim in, boy, F-P-O-F-F. No, that can't be right. Listening on WKBT. What's the city, Jim? In New Hampshire?
Hi, Tom. It's Spofford, New
Spofford.
Hampshire.
Spofford, okay.
Southwestern New Hampshire.
I'm missing the S. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Thanks for the opportunity, Tom. And, Senator, thank you so much for your service to our country. I'm a really big fan.
Thanks, Jim.
A lot of us down here in southern Vermont, southern New Hampshire, and western Mass are trying to get a nuclear plant shut down as scheduled. To that end, on Saturday, April 14th, the people are going to come together in Brattleboro, Vermont, for a rally to support the state of Vermont. State of Vermont has ruled, or at least directed, the company Entergy to cease operations, as they've scheduled to do in 2012. Yet the federal government says the people don't have a say in this matter. I want to thank you for joining us at the rally next Saturday, but also get your opinion on another, what some people see as a corporate abuse.
Well, Jim, my expectation is I'm going to be at that rally. As a matter of fact, this is an issue that I have worked very hard on. For people who are not familiar with the issue, it's a question of a nuclear power plant in southern Vermont having been online now for 40 years, and that was the contract that people were told was going to be the case. And Entergy, who owns the nuclear power plant, has asked for a 20-year extension for a variety of reasons. Some of us think that is not a good idea. The Vermont State Senate, in accordance with an agreement signed with Entergy when they bought the company, voted 26-4, very strong bipartisan vote, to say that we should not extend the contract of Vermont Yankee. Vermont Yankee went to court. The court ruled in favor of them. The state is appealing that decision. I agree with the need to appeal. So I think that the future of Vermont in terms of energy, and we're having a conference on it just this Monday, has a lot to do with energy efficiency. It has a lot to do with moving aggressively to wind, solar, geothermal, biomass, public transportation. That's what I believe the future of my state, Vermont, should be. I think nationally what we have to understand, whether you are for or against nuclear power, what everybody has got to understand is the nuclear power industry would collapse tomorrow unless it continued to receive huge amounts of federal welfare. It is one of the major federal welfare recipients and has been for decades. So this is an industry that is now trying to build new plants, and everybody understands they can't go forward without loan guarantees from the federal government. They have a very strong insurance program from the federal government, billions of dollars in research and development from the federal government, getting rid of their waste from the federal government. So when you talk about one of the great debates we're having in Washington right now is whether we really move forward aggressively in sustainable energy, or whether we remain wedded to the old concepts, including nuclear. But bottom line here is nuclear power would not survive one day without enormous amounts of taxpayer support.
Mel in Portland, Oregon, you're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Yes, Senator, thank you for the job you do for us. I called your office, and I hope they were able to get you this article. There's an article in the Christian Science Monitor, February 23rd, 2012, something that the oil companies do not want the American people to know. Last year, they exported 200,000 barrels a day to India, China, and South America of refined gasoline and diesel fuel. This year, they are going to export 600,000 barrels a day of refined diesel and gasoline to China, India, and South America. Now, they don't want people to know this is part of the reason our prices are going up, and this is overproduction. They said they have so much refined gasoline and diesel fuel that they cannot use it here, and they are exporting it. Do you know this?
I didn't know the exact amounts, but I did know that we were exporting gas. And this just speaks to the what I would call a big lie. that the issue is supply and demand. It is not supply and demand. What the caller is telling us is that there is so much supply in this country, we're actually exporting gasoline. So that's a very important point to be made, and I think it speaks to the absurdity of what many of our Republican friends in the oil industry are saying. The other point that I would make is, as I mentioned earlier, no question to my mind that when Wall Street speculators, that's Goldman Sachs, Morgan Stanley, and others, now control over 80% of the oil futures market, and their function in life is only to make as much money as possible. They don't use any of the product, but of course, you know, they're not airlines, they're not trucking companies. They just want to speculate, drive prices up, and sell and make a profit. But you also then have our friends at ExxonMobil and the oil industry, who are enormously powerful politically. And let me just make the wild and crazy prediction that at the end of the quarter, when gas in Vermont is now $4 a gallon, you're going to see huge profits from these guys. And let's never forget that in the last decade alone, the major oil companies made $1 trillion in profit. $1 trillion in profit. And so you got the oil companies making huge profits. You have Wall Street driving up prices. And you got the average consumer in a rural state like mine traveling 30 or 40 miles to work and back, often seeing his or her wages going down, struggling to stay alive economically, and now they're forced to pay $4 for a gallon of gas. It's really outrageous.
Senator Bernie Sanders with us. It's our Brunch with Bernie, our national town hall meeting here on the Tom Hartman Program. Your chance to talk with Senator Sanders, 866-97-THO, and we'll be back with more of your calls for Bernie. Check out his website at sanders.senate.gov.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
And you can get the free Tom Hartman iPhone and iPad app in the App Store or over at tomhartman.com, where you can also drop into our free live chat room and build your own blog.
Taxes, after all, are the dues that we pay for the privilege of membership in an organized society. But I am afraid we have many who still do not recognize their advantages and want to avoid paying their dues.
Well, best wishes for Good Friday today, if it's that for you, or Passover, which begins at sundown tonight, if it's that for you. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, and we're talking with Senator Bernie Sanders. It's our Brunch with Bernie hour, taking your calls, our national town hall meeting. Bill in Albany, New York, you're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Hey, good afternoon. I'm one of the sufferers of BES, or Bernie Envy Syndrome. I live in the state neighborhood.
So thank you very much, Bill. I have not heard about that particular illness before.
Yeah, it's devastating, really. Okay, what I wanted to ask you, Bernie, is if in fact there can be any type of movement in increasing the top level of Social Security taxation. Today is the first day of baseball season. After the fifth inning of the first game, Alex Rodriguez no longer pays Social Security tax. He will not pay any FICA after the fifth inning of the first game of the year. And I just was hoping there could be a move afoot.
Well, Bill, I'm going to increase your envy here by telling you that I've introduced that legislation.
Oh, we just lost Bill.
We have done that. What Bill is talking about, I want everybody to understand it because it's very, very important. There are enormous attacks against Social Security precisely because Social Security is a government program that has done exactly what it was designed to do. It has been enormously successful. With minimum administrative cost, Social Security has reduced poverty among seniors from 50% before Social Security to 10% today, not to mention providing enormous support for people with disabilities, and for widows and orphans. Now, those people who do not believe that government should play an important role in our lives in protecting the elderly or the sick or the children have been attacking Social Security for every which way. And a lot of what they're saying is basically dishonest. For example, Social Security has been attacked for adding to the deficit. It has not. Social Security is funded by the payroll tax, an independent source of funding. Social Security has a $2.5 trillion surplus. Social Security today can pay out every benefit owed to every eligible American for the next 25 years. What Bill is talking about is the fact that right now, if you make $110,000 a year, you're going to pay your Social Security FICA tax on that $110,000. If you make $1 million, all you pay is on the first $110,000. There is a ceiling, which is at $110,000. If you lift that ceiling, and you can start not at $110,000, but even at $250,000, if you do that and ask people to pay Social Security taxes on that higher income, what you will do is make Social Security solvent for the next 75 years, which is what actuaries want. That's the simple solution. I've introduced that legislation. We have a number of co-sponsors. And in fact, interestingly enough, that is exactly the legislation that Barack Obama campaigned on in 2008.
Wayne in Chicago, listening in Chicago's Progressive Talk, WCPT. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Good afternoon. It's an honor to speak with you, Senator Sanders.
Thank you.
Yes, my question is, the Commodities Futures Trading Commission, my question is, are there laws already on the books to prevent the speculators from just driving up the price of the oil futures through speculation? And what am I trying to say here?
Well, I think you're saying,
why isn't the CFTC enforcing the law? And are there laws?
Right, why is the CFTC? Because they don't, the speculators don't take the actual delivery of the oil.
Right.
So why are they even allowed to speculate on it in the first place?
Wayne is raising an issue that I and a number of others are working on right now. And it is a source of enormous frustration. And I'll tell you why. As Wayne implies, in fact, as part of the Dodd-Frank financial reform bill passed a couple of years ago, there is a very clear provision in that bill which says that the Commodity Futures Trading Commission has got to end excessive speculation. That's what they have to do. And they were told that they had to do it in January 2011. Well, now we are 14 months after that, and they still have not acted. And that's why some of us have put forth legislation to say that they have got to act, and as soon as that's passed, within 2 weeks. Now, they will tell you the reason they haven't acted is there's a lawsuit. They have told you against them by Wall Street. They will tell you that there's just a whole lot of paperwork that they have to do, regulations, rules that they have to develop. But I think that given the severity of this crisis of high oil and gas prices, which is impacting not only millions and millions of individuals who cannot afford to pay $4 or $4.25 for a gallon of gas, it's impacting the entire economy as we try to get out of this horrendous recession. So many of us in the Senate have met with Gary Gensler. He's the chairman of the commission, and we said to him in so many words, get your act together, do what the law says. Use the emergency provisions that you have. Unfortunately, Mr. Gensler has not acted, and we are going to continue to stay on that issue to demand that he does what the law requires him to do.
Eric in Los Angeles, you're on the air with Senator Sanders. Eric?
Senator Sanders, hello. I had a quick question about the budget. And the Republicans keep on saying that the Senate hasn't passed a budget in I don't know how long, and I wanted to find out, you know, your thoughts on that and why that's happening.
Well, one of the reasons, well, I think that's probably not accurate. We're operating under the budget that was passed when the super committee did not come up with a conclusion. So there is a budget out there which will call for significant cuts in military spending and in discretionary spending. I'm not happy about it, but that is a budget that we are operating under. The main point here, I think, is that our Republican friends will tell us that in the House they have passed the budget, or they will pass the budget, and it's true. it's important to look at what that so-called Ryan budget is about. And what the Republican budget is about, which I think all of us have got to fight very, very hard, is more of this trickle-down economics in which huge tax breaks will go to millionaires. There will be an extension of Bush's tax breaks for the rich, massive cuts in Medicaid, the complete transformation of Medicare into a voucher program, which will give seniors a check, and then they go out and find some private insurance company, and that check will in no way cover their needs if there is a serious illness. Republicans also are laying the groundwork for cuts in Social Security, cutting Social Security Administration, and cutting virtually every program that low and moderate income people depend upon in our country. So what the Ryan budget is about, which has passed the House, is the same old, and it's a budget that apparently Mitt Romney strongly supports. More tax breaks for millionaires and billionaires and cuts to many, many programs that millions of people depend upon every day just to get by.
Phil, in Helena, Montana, you're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Hi, Senator. This is a question. I know that you've been working on, or support at least. My question is if the Supreme Court rules that the mandatory provisions of the health care law is unconstitutional, what do you think the chances are of the Congress passing a Medicare for All single-payer health care plan?
Well, Phil, that's my position, and I think certainly if our friends on the Supreme Court who decided that Bush would become president in 2000, who gave us Citizens United and the extraordinary legal doctrine that corporations are people and can spend as much money as they want on political campaigns, if these guys now decide that healthcare reform is unconstitutional, I certainly will go forward, reintroduce the bill that I had introduced, and that is a Medicare for All single-payer program. Because at the end of the day, and here's the irony, Phil, here's the Supreme Court, maybe, we certainly hope that is not going to be the case, but considering whether or not we have a right to pass healthcare reform, every other major country on earth guarantees healthcare to all of their people as a right. And the Supreme Court here is considering whether we can come forward with a program that doesn't even guarantee health care to all as a right. It takes a step forward. So to answer your question, Phil, yes, some of us will be introducing a Medicare for All single-payer program.
Brunch with Bernie, your opportunity to talk with Senator Bernie Sanders. Our national town hall meeting here on the Tom Hartman program. It's 45 minutes past the hour. Check out Bernie's website, sanders.senate.gov. You can sign his constitutional amendment to roll back Citizens United.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit tomhartman.com for audio and video archives.
It's also a great news site, sanders.senate.gov, and you get the Bernie Buzz, so you can sign up for his newsletter. It's a fascinating news source.
But, my friend, stop, look, and listen. You will find what the propagandists do not tell you.
When many little people in many little places do many little things, then the whole world changes, you see. We are looking for the same thing.
Welcome back to the place where despair is not an option, the Tom Hartman Program. It's our Brunch with Bernie Hour. Senator Bernie Sanders taking your calls. Terry in Bluefield, West Virginia. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Yes, sir. I was just trying to figure out. Okay, they talk about the possibility of Social Security being becoming insolvent. I'm on Social Security, and the reason, as I understand, is that Congress, rather than putting our Social Security payments into a trust fund as it was supposed to have been originally set up, is that it goes into a general fund, and so y'all in Congress just go ahead and spend it like you want it. Is that correct?
Well, it's half correct, Terry, but here's what happened. During the Vietnam War, President Johnson, in order to pay for the war, essentially, and to hide the cost of the war, merged the two funds. That is true. But what is not true, Terry, is some of my right-wing friends will say, well, there really is no money in the Social Security Trust Fund. because it's just IOUs, just IOUs. The fact of the matter is there is a trust fund today of $2.5 trillion that can bail out benefits for the next 25 years. And what Social Security does do, as you would want them to do, is to lend money out at an interest rate. They don't put the money underneath their mattress. They make money. So, Terry, in one sense, you're right. The funds were merged back in the 60s, but in another sense, you are wrong. There is clearly a very separate ledger. Go to the Social Security Administration. I suspect they have it up in their website, what the surplus is and what how long it can pay out benefits, and that number is about 25 years. So bottom line is Social Security is very solvent. We want to make it even more solvent, but anyone who tells you that Social Security is going bankrupt is not telling you the truth.
And what happens at 25 years?
It will pay out something like 80% of all benefits.
Okay, unless we raise the cap, right?
Right.
Yeah, okay.
So the goal is to make it solvent for 75 years. And again, when people talk about an IOU, look, the not good news is that we have a $15 trillion national debt, and the country pays its debts.
Mm-hmm.
So this is not just, you know, pieces of paper. This is the faith and credit of the United States of America.
These treasury bills. Ken in Jones, Oklahoma. You're on the air with Senator Bernie Sanders. Thanks for watching Free Speech TV.
Thank you. I was wanting to know, is there anything that we can do to try to help save Medicare? I'm disabled myself, and without Medicare, I'm pretty much in real bad shape. And I live in probably the reddest state in the union, and there's not a whole lot I can do here, but anything else that I can do, and I strongly support you, Senator Sanders. Do you have any ideas of anything that we can do?
Well, for a start, Ken, you know, you're right. Oklahoma is certainly one of the more conservative states in the country, and you have two very conservative senators. But I got to believe that you're not the only person in Oklahoma who is on Medicare, who needs Medicare, or is on Social Security, who needs Social Security. And I think that your voice, please raise your voice in your own state and get the word out to senators and members of Congress all over this country that proposals to make massive cuts in Medicare or to transform Medicare, if you have, and I certainly don't know Ken's situation, but if you have serious health problems and the government says, okay, here's a check for $7,000-$8,000 and good luck to you, you know, that will last if you end up in a hospital for 2 days. It just doesn't work. And as a nation, we just cannot do that. So we've got to strengthen Medicare. We have to make it a cost-effective program. And Ken, you know, do what you can in Oklahoma, because I just never believe that there aren't thousands and thousands of people in Oklahoma and every other state in this country who want to protect the basic safety net of this country.
Jacob, how much time do we have? 2 minutes. Okay, great. Rodney in Chicago Heights, Illinois, listening to WCPT. You're on with Senator Sanders.
Senator Sanders, I was just wondering if Congress had the power to arrest the head of the CFTC and jail him for contempt of Congress and force him to get busy.
Well, I don't know that I would arrest him, but we are thinking of some very, very strong action, legislation and ideas to make sure that he does what he's supposed to do, or if he can't do it, somebody else does do it. But people lose faith in government when here you have a situation where Congress finally did the right thing. Most times Congress doesn't do the right thing. They did the right thing, passed good law, and now that law is not being implemented. So I share your frustration, Rodney. I don't know that we're going to arrest anybody, but we are going to make the CFTC do what they're supposed to do.
Bernie, I got 12 calls waiting for you, but we only have about a minute left, so it wouldn't be fair to the caller to not be able to get a call out. Your final thoughts for the week?
Well, my final thoughts is that what the job numbers told us today is that the economy remains very, very rough. A whole lot of people are looking for work, or they're working part-time when they want to work full-time. Older people have lost their jobs and are working at a fraction of the wages that they used to get. Young people graduating college deeply in debt. These are issues that we can address as a society and as a nation. But to do that, we're going to have to demand that the United States Congress and the President start working for everybody, all of our people, even if you're not making millions of dollars in campaign contributions, rather than just the very few at the upper end, top end of the income ladder. So my message today, and I think, Tom, it's the message you and I provide every week. In a democratic society, it's the people who are supposed to rule. But the people are not going to rule unless they're not involved in the political process, unless they're not out there talking to their friends and their neighbors, and demanding that our government does what it can do and should do for ordinary people.
So the bottom line is get out there, get active, and show up.
Absolutely.
Senator Bernie Sanders, thank you so much, Bernie.
Good to be with you.
Always great having you on. We will be back with Anything Goes Friday here on the Tom Hartman Program. Stick around. It's 57 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Anything Goes Friday here on the Tom Hartman Program, and the lines are full. Let's pick up some calls. Ryan in South Hadley, Mass. Hey, Ryan, what's up? Thanks for listening to AM 1400.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
Great. But I'll get better. What's up?
I'm doing pretty well today. I had a question. It was kind of geared towards Congressman Sanders, but do you mind if I ask you anyway?
Sure.
I read an article the other day about Vermont being the first state to label the genetically modified foods with GMO labels.
Mm-hmm.
And the second part of the article was about if they went through with it, that Monsanto was already threatened to sue the state of Vermont.
I think that might be like a 8 or 10 year old story. I mean, there was that big battle that Ben and Jerry's had, and I think it was with Monsanto over labeling their ice cream as non-RGBH. Although GMOs are arguably something different than bovine growth hormone. Yeah, frankly, I'm sorry, I don't know. I don't know the details of that. That would have been a good question for Bernie. You're right, and I'm sorry we didn't get to it. We always,
anyway.
You know, we always end up with Bernie. There's so many people who want to get in. And anyhow, Ryan, thanks for the call. If you find out, let me know, okay, and post it over on our daily blog, and I'll report it to our listeners. Dave in Sterling Heights, Michigan, listening to WDTR. Hey, Dave, what's up?
Hi, Tom.
Or WDTW.
Yes, thank you. I just had a question. It was about the oil leases, because I think that oil is a natural resource of the United States, and the United States government writes the leases for the oil companies to drill on U.S. land.
Right.
And currently, I believe the oil that is drilled from U.S. land is marketed all over the world for the highest price.
Right.
I'm just wondering, when the oil leases are written, say for Exxon or whatever, to drill on the land, why don't they write in that certain percentage of the oil is sold in the U.S. at a discounted rate, and they can make their profit in the rest of the world, but for us getting our own oil back from them, they should give us a discounted rate. I don't understand why.
Because that would be too smart. That would be too smart. Congress defines those rules, and Congress is owned by the oil industry, and that's why most of these oil leases aren't even, we sell that oil to the companies, right? The oil companies, when they drill, they buy oil, unless it's mineral, unless it's one of those states or areas where it is, it's not like it's on your property and they're buying the mineral rights from you. But when they're drilling on federal lands, they buy that oil, and they pay a certain amount for it, but it's a fixed amount. And if the world price of oil goes up dramatically, they make a whole lot more money. It should be a percentage. It should be a percentage of what they get, but it's not. And there should be some restrictions on it, as you point out, and there are not. These are things to take up with members of Congress and the United States Senate, because this has to do with, how these laws are put into place. And frankly, the lobbyists got there before you and I did, and I think we need to change that, but that's the way it is. Walter in Scott, Arkansas. Hey, Walter, what's on your mind? Thanks for watching Free Speech TV.
I wanted to check. Is there any way we can find out whether or not the Koch brothers or any entities under their control are buying oil or gasoline futures to help raise the price of this thing to embarrass Obama?
I don't know. I genuinely don't know. I think that you learn these things after the fact. I believe that it was Koch Industries that had leased several tankers of gasoline and oil and moved them offshore during the last time that the oil prices were spiking. And I've seen several articles floating around about that, although I can't attest to their accuracy. Walter, once again, I have to say I don't know. I'm sorry. We do know that in 2008, two guys on Wall Street cornered a large chunk of the oil market. We do know that the banksters are controlling large portions, as Bernie said, about 80% of the total oil futures market. Exactly who it is and how they're doing it and whether the Koch brothers are involved with it, through five different front companies or not, I just don't know. Jerry in Long Island, listening on WWRL. Hey, Jerry, what's up?
Yeah, thanks for taking my call. Yeah, on the so-called stand your ground law, I don't think many people are aware of the fact that even in this politically blue and heavily Democratic-leaning state like New York, even in this state, a stand your ground law is seriously being considered. And I'm calling to both criticize and draw attention to the fact that despite the backdrop of the tragic and seemingly unjustified shooting of Trayvon Martin, of course, in Florida, Well, despite all that, thanks to both the NRA and ALEC, even in this politically blue state, even in this state that has so many Democrats in it, we have Republicans in the state Senate who either are introducing or have introduced and are seriously considering a so-called stand your ground law for New York. And it, like they say, if it could happen in New York, it could happen any place.
Yeah.
And what people have to realize, what's so bad about these laws, is that this changes the whole legal concept of both what constitutes justified homicide and self-defense. And it changes the whole concept in a very dangerous way, where you even had the police commissioner of New York on this very same radio station listening to you on earlier. He was being interviewed, and not only did he say it's against the law, but I think he really put his finger on it when he says it's confusing. And that's what it does. It confuses and creates ambiguity, a lot of question marks in the law that used to be very simple with respect to what constitutes justified homicide and what does not.
You're absolutely right, Jerry. You're absolutely right. Yeah. And since Florida, thank you for the call. Florida was the first state to adopt this law that was promoted heavily by Walmart, the nation's largest gun seller, and the NRA, and promoted, run through ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Council, the Koch brothers' legislation mill, where they bring in Republican state members of Congress, members of state house and senates and assemblies, and pair them one-on-one with lobbyists. Since that law has been put into place now in 20 or 21 states, since 2006, so-called justifiable homicides in the United States have gone up 25%, and deaths shootings caused by police officers have also gone up. So this whole meme of, I call them the shoot first laws, and I think it's infecting our nation and doing so in a way that is not good. Jerry in Braniff City, Illinois. Hey, Jerry, thanks for listening to Sirius XM. What's up? Jerry?
Hello.
You are on the air.
First things first, I was talking to my cat, Alice, and she said she would love to have a date with Higgins sometime,
Good luck.
Really.
If it's a cat, I suppose Higgins would get along, although Higgins doesn't actually even play well with other cats. He's pretty crazy.
Gets along pretty good with people and cats both. But anyway, Tom, it's a privilege to listen to your show. I mean, I consider you the most brilliant talk show host of our time.
But?
Or most brilliant economist of our time. But
I know there's a but coming.
Thing that I don't agree with you on, and that's your vegetarianism stance.
All right.
Not from a scientific or an evolutionary or a health standpoint.
Okay.
Life on this planet evolved over 250,000 years on a very high protein meat diet.
Not true. Elephants are the largest and strongest animals on Earth, and they're total vegetarians. Cows eat are total vegetarians.
Yeah, I'm talking about human beings.
We do not share the same teeth that your cat and my cat have. We are not carnivores. We don't have the same teeth that cows have. We're not grain eaters or grass eaters. We don't have the same teeth as dogs have, which are omnivores. They eat both vegetables and meat. We are somewhere between omnivores and fruitarians or fruit and vegetarians. I mean, just look at our, you know, the intestinal tract of a carnivore is about the same as the length of their body. Our intestinal tract is, I believe, about five times the length of our body. The intestinal tract of a pure vegetarian animal is much longer than ours. So, you know, I don't disagree with you that humans evolved eating small amounts of meat as a condiment or as a secondary protein source. But in any indigenous society around the world, I mean, look it up, Jerry, you will find that humans and classically, outside of very extreme environments, like, you know, people way up in the Arctic, people use meat protein as a condiment, as a flavoring or as a spice, not as a primary source of food.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
15 minutes past the hour. More on Anything Goes Friday. Come right after this.
In olden days, a glimpse of stocking was looked on as something shocking. Now heaven knows, anything goes.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Gus in Woodville, Texas. Gus, thanks for watching Free Speech TV. You watch it on Dish, Direct, Cable?
On Dish.
On Dish Network. Okay, great.
You and Free Speech TV make it worth paying the monthly bill, matter of fact.
Well, thank you. So what's up?
I'm curious. You often mention Congress being owned by oil companies, and I don't disagree. But what can we, the people, do now to liberate Obama from the financial banksters and thus enable him to liberate the Congress from the oil and gas plunders?
I see it as a kind of a three-step process. First of all, we have to have enough people mobilized, enough people in the streets, enough people in the blogs, enough people writing letters to the editor, enough people calling in to talk radio, enough people talking to their neighbors, enough people talking to their coworkers over the water cooler, who are, you know, a genuine progressive movement, so that politicians like Bernie Sanders and Sherrod Brown and Barack Obama, you know, who I believe would like to be a progressive, he was at one point in his political career, he certainly understands these principles, will have the wind behind their backs so that they can do these things. And secondly, if we have enough people who are out there and involved, and if enough people infiltrate, in particular the Democratic Party, but I'd say all of them, you know, get involved in all, if you're a Republican and you think that Eisenhower was right and Paul Ryan is crazy, you know, infiltrate the Republican Party. But in any case, you know, as in show up, become a precinct committee person. Make these parties work. Make them work for us. And then if we can get this president reelected, there's probably going to be at least two vacancies in the Supreme Court in the next 5 years. It's a virtual certainty, I think, that Ruth Bader Ginsburg is going to leave the court and that Justice Anthony Kennedy will leave the court. And I'm not, you know, I'm not wishing either one of them ill. It's just, you know, fact of matter. They're both rather elderly and frail. And Kennedy is the swing vote. I mean, Ruth Bader Ginsburg is a very good progressive, but Kennedy was a Reagan appointee, I believe, or maybe a Bush appointee. But he's the swing vote. And when he's replaced, if he's replaced by a Democratic president, all these 5-4 decisions that we've had, and there's been almost nothing but from the strip search decision to Citizens United to, I mean, you know, all the way back to Bush v. Gore, all these 5-4 decisions are suddenly going to become 4-5 decisions. You're going to see this court reversing itself, including, I hope, on Citizens United. And if and when that happens, then Congress can once again have the power to pass legislation to get money out of politics, and which liberates the politicians from the big money interests. I don't see, you know, another way to do this. It's going to take basically a popular uprising. And by that, I don't mean the black bloc. I don't mean people, you know, out there throwing stones at buildings. I mean people actually getting involved in the political process and supporting those politicians, going to Bernie.org and kicking in a few bucks for Bernie's campaign, going to SherrodBrown.com and kicking in a few bucks for his campaign, you know, whatever it may be, those kinds of things. And all the other good, you know, good progressive politicians out there, Jan Schakowsky, all of them are running for re-election, and we need to be supporting all of them. So that's my answer to you, Gus. I think that we definitely need to be getting active. Dan in Sterling Heights, Michigan, listening on WDTW. Hey, Dan, what's up?
Hey, Tom.
good to speak to you again. Happy Friday.
Say what?
I said happy Friday.
Oh, thank you, and the same to you.
it's a little bit off the beaten path in terms of topics, but I want to talk about progressivism at home.
Mm-hmm.
And I want to talk about it in terms of basically challenging all the listeners out there that are parents that things that are important to liberalism and progressivism, like empathy and accountability and responsibility, in how we talk to our kids, it means that they're good citizens at school, that they end up to be good citizens out in the workforce. And we really have a responsibility, you know, to put the next generation out there. You know, I think there's a lot of specifics, you know, and I have a very unique family. I have six kids from a first marriage. They all live with me. I have a blended family. I'm remarried. And we don't own an Xbox. We don't the kids don't have cell phones and technology and things like that. And they have a lot of books. And at a very young age, I mean, as young as 9 or 10, we talk about what's going on in politics and what it means to them. And so I just, you know, as sort of a message to challenge people to think about how they're doing that with their kids is the reason for my call.
Yeah, I don't disagree with you at all, even though neither would Rick Santorum. During the 18 or so years that our kids were growing up, Louise and I had no television in the house, just like you. And I mean, not just no Xbox, no television, period. And from 87 until, well, actually until, I'm sorry, it's from 1978 until we started this radio show. In fact, Louise and I didn't have a television, which was in early 2003. So that's a long time. But, yeah, totally with you. Ken in Coos Bay, Oregon. I'm listening on KBBR. Ken, a quick one? Got a minute?
Yes. I have a suggestion, and that would be to start a national recall effort on all Republicans and Blue Dog Democrats, whether they be city councilmen or state senators and, you know, congressmen, everything.
Yeah, well, that's a negative response or a reactionary response, and sometimes it's entirely appropriate. I mean, look at what's going on with Scott Walker. I would say, though, that, you know, we're only 8-9 months out from an election when every single member of the House of Representatives is up for election, a third of the Senate is up for re-election. In most states, most state legislators are up for election. Most of your local city officials, or many of them, are going to be up for election. So I would be trying right now, and it's actually starting to get a little late for this, but I would be trying right now to get good progressive candidates on the ballot or identify them and get out there and work for them. And let's try to get good people in, because getting bad people out is only half the battle. And one of the easiest way to get them out is to vote in somebody who's really good. Ken, thanks for the call.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
In other words, let's always try to think of how can we be proactive rather than reactive. I think we react way too often. We need to be moving forward. LBD with the Water Cooler Wars. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Is that a picture of me and my parents and my little brothers? I guess it was. Amazing. I think I was like 13 when that picture. Anyhow, welcome back. Brian in Omaha, Nebraska. Hey, Brian, thanks for watching Free Speech TV. What's up?
Hey, Tom. Great to be on the show. I really appreciate what you do.
Thank you. Thank you for calling.
You know, you're really knowledgeable about Reagan and what he did and how he deregulated everything that kept us safe. And one thing I never hear you bring up is the usury tax. And he did that. That was something where a company could only charge 30%. You know, they were allowed to make a profit, but they weren't allowed to gouge. Reagan got rid of that. And that's where, you know, companies like oil companies can squeeze commodities and make them harder to get to charge more money.
Right. I think you may be right and I may be wrong, but I think that you're mixing two things up. The usury is charging excessive interest. And Richard Nixon, I believe, was the president who repealed. We used to have a law on the books that said that if you charge more than 10% interest, it's a crime, or maybe it was 12%. And when inflation started really jacking up there after the Vietnam War was over, it was either Nixon, it might have even been Carter, who repealed that law. I'm pretty sure it was Nixon, though. And that ended the usury laws, which opened the door for, you know, the banksters to charge 30-40%, for the payday loan people to charge 400%. On the other hand, there was this windfall profits tax, which, again, I believe was put into place by Nixon during the oil crisis. It certainly extended through the Carter administration. And so it wouldn't surprise me if that was the tax that you're talking about, the windfall profits tax that Reagan repealed, although I don't know. I'd have to look it up. I don't know the details on that. But it was around that time.
Correct me on that, Tom. I appreciate that. Hey, you know, I just want to mention everything the Republicans talk about. Let's have the private sector. Let's give it to the private sector. And I think back, the Army went to the private sector back in the 40s. And see where they are now as far as cost and being out of control. Yeah. Nixon privatized, or the private sector, the healthcare system. And look how out of cost procedures are. It's just so out of hand. Everything the private sector does just is detrimental to
everything, but we should definitely call it the corporate sector rather than the private sector, and the public sector should be called the government sector, so people understand what people are talking about, first of all, and then secondly, we need to make clear definitions, and this is a national conversation we need to have, which is, what are the things that are appropriately the functions of government? I don't think you do want the government making my cars or my shoes or my sports coat or any, you know, there's no reason for government to do those things. Let you know, private corporations compete, and individuals and small businesses compete in that marketplace. Let's regulate that marketplace, in other words, prevent large monopolies from forming so that small businesses can still exist, but let it remain a private marketplace. On the other hand, in the public sphere, education should be, you know, free all the way up through medical school and PhDs, and it should be paid for by government. It should be provided by government, like it is in most developed countries around the world. Healthcare should be free, and by free, of course, I mean it's paid for with our tax dollars in both cases, and just like it is in most other countries of the world. And obviously, police services, fire services, the military, things like that, those are appropriately parts of the public sector or the government sector, let's call it. And let's just be clear about what those should be, and then we can have an honest discussion with people like, you know, the libertarians who think that government shouldn't, for example, have any role in old age pensions and Social Security and caring for people who fall through the cracks with everything from food stamps to unemployment insurance, you know. But let's have an honest conversation about it. Excellent point, Brian. Thank you very much for the call, and thanks for watching Free Speech TV. In Charlotte, North Carolina, Scott, listening on Sirius XM. Hey, Scott, what's up?
Hey, Tom. I was watching a show produced by Discovery Channel, and they were talking about Operation Sunshield, where the government is taking C-130 planes and creating clouds, and they were talking about this was because of global warming and trying to combat it. If the government would announce that, wouldn't that show even the Christian fundamentalists that it's actually happening?
Yeah, I haven't seen the show that you're talking about, Scott, but I can tell you that there is no government program to create clouds to stop global warming. There has been experimentation, and I'm assuming by government scientists, as to, you know, ways to increase what's called the albedo effect, the reflectivity of the the upper atmosphere. And in fact, some of it goes back to 9/11. In the 3 days after 9/11, there were no planes flying, and so all of that stratospheric, all those stratospheric clouds or lower tropospheric clouds that you see, the contrails or whatever you want to call them, vanished. And the Earth actually absorbed more heat more sunlight during that time. And there's some really fascinating science on what happened in those 3 days after 9/11. But, you know, what are we going to do about too much carbon dioxide, too much greenhouse gas in the air? It's still a huge subject of scientific debate. Scott, thank you for the call. The main thing we need to do is stop putting it in the air. And then secondly, I frankly think that rather than trying to deal with it and things like, you know, let's put giant parasols up there, let's bounce it out, let's throw particulate matter into the air, I think it's better to look at carbon sequestration, look at ways of pulling it out. And there's a whole technology there. In Blakely, Pennsylvania. Hey, Will, what's up? Whoop, I'm sorry. I pushed the wrong button. Sean in York, or not the wrong button, but a different button. Sean in York, Pennsylvania. You're on the air. We'll get to Will in a second.
How you doing?
Very well, thank you. What's up?
I was going to ask, isn't the Stand Your Ground law, doesn't it have to do more about being in your house or in your yard, then
no. That's the difference. Under the old laws, if you were in your own home or if you were in your own yard on your own property and you felt threatened, well, you would have to. There's a fairly high bar that you have to demonstrate has been crossed before you take the life of another person. But under these so-called stand your ground laws, they have to do with your ability to do this in a public place, in some place that is not your home, your castle, even though they call it the castle doctrine. So that's the big problem with them, or one of them. Will, in Blakesley, Pennsylvania. Hey, Will, what's up?
Hey, Tom, how you doing? You know that thing with the RNC and they're banning string and then the mask, and but they're allowing handguns down in Tampa?
Yeah.
Right. I know this is a little provocative, but it's just hypothetical. I'm not advocating violence or anything, but I think it's a question that's worthy of some discussion. What if the Occupy Wall Street were to call their bluff and actually bring guns? What do you think the police would do?
Shoot them.
If there was, right. Right. Exactly.
I mean, it's just,
that's the point, isn't it? If because they're not Tea Partiers, right? I'm sure that is exactly what happened.
The fact of the matter is that the police know that the Tea Partiers are funded by the establishment. You've got the big, what was it? Jamie Dimon's bank, I believe it was, J.P. Morgan, donated $4.5 million to the Chicago Benevolent Police Association or whatever it is. And then all of a sudden the police are very, very, enthusiastic about beating up Occupy Wall Street people. You know, when the Tea Partiers show up and they're showing up in a $350,000 bus with a $100,000 paint job on it of the Constitution on the side, and they've got a sound stage that costs $150,000 a day to rent, and they've got a park permit that took months to get, and you had to go through a long permitting process. The police know that they're dealing with people who are part of or acting on behalf of the power structure, the institutional power structure, the rich and powerful in this country. On the other hand, when you got a bunch of kids who have nothing, who are squatting in a park, the police know that they're dealing with people who are not the power structure. And there's a difference in the way that we deal with people who have power in the United States and people who don't. And Will, a good rhetorical point, but that's why I said, if the occupiers showed up with guns, it would be the absolute worst thing they could do. Even though the Tea Partiers have done it, and they've done these, open carry things and all this stuff, and they're so proud of it, yeah. It would be the last thing that I would ever. Mike in Big Creek, California. Hey, Mike, what's up? Thanks for watching
Tom.
Free Speech TV.
Yeah, this is Mike Link. Can you explain to me how the filibuster changed from having to stand up and speak and speak and speak to just a gentleman's agreement?
Yeah, I used to know the date and the administration, but I don't any longer. It largely changed in the 70s and 80s, actually I can't tell you. I don't have those details at the tip of my finger. My understanding though is that it's always been basically a gentleman's agreement. That it used to be that when, like, Jesse Helms tied up the Senate for 24 hours, famously filibustering the Civil Rights Act back in the 60s, that he didn't actually have to do that. He could have done what Tom Coburn does now and simply say, I'm going to filibuster, I object, and the Senate could have just said, okay, that's fine, we're going to set that aside. But the Senate, whoever controlled the Senate at that time, allowed that filibuster to go on for the theater of it, just like Bernie Sanders did his 9-hour filibuster, I believe it was 9, it might have been 7 hours, a while ago for the theater of it. So the way that the filibuster is portrayed in Mr. Smith Goes to Washington, I believe, and I may stand corrected on this, but I don't think so, is that it has always been kind of optional that you must stand there. And I have been a big advocate of, and Bernie Sanders is, of requiring people to stand there, of saying, the minute that the filibuster ends, then there will be a vote, right? That's it. As long as you can stand there and filibuster. But the practical reality is if you got more than 3 or 4 people who are willing to take turns on a filibuster, it could conceivably never end, and the Senate just doesn't do that. So, but I'm not a parliamentarian, Mike, but I'm pretty sure that what's happened over the years isn't so much a difference in the rules, but a difference in the way that they play the game. We'll be back 45 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
It's Anything Goes, Good Friday, Passover Friday, and we're going to check in with the Talk Radio News Service here in just a few minutes. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, and a representative from the Talk Radio News Service on the line with us. Who is this?
I know. It's such a surprise. It's Pastor Heidi McGinnis with Christian Solidarity International.
Oh, that's right. Reverend Heidi McGinnis.
Hi.
CSI is the group that took Ellen and I and Joe Madison and Rusty Humphreys to and has done so many times to South Sudan and has been working to free slaves there. And,
yes, and you wrote the most remarkable article I remembered years ago for Talk Magazine, I believe it was. You were, mm-hmm. It was so poignant. I called and left word to thank you.
Well, thank you. That's very kind of you. Reverend McGinnis, what is the status of South Sudan? For our listeners who don't know, let me just set this up, if I may. There's North Sudan and South Sudan. South Sudan separated officially in the last year or so, but there was this horrible civil war. And off to the side is Darfur, which is technically part of North Sudan. Mr. Bashir in the north, which is largely Arab, has been indicted as a war criminal for the genocide in Darfur, and now he's bombing along the North-South Sudan border. And at the south, President Salva Kiir is trying to lead South Sudan in a positive direction. They're having some terrible problems. This is a state that's larger, a nation that's larger than the state of Texas, and has only a few hundred miles of paved road, and is just at the very beginning of development. So what's going – first of all, correct any errors of fact that I might have just laid out.
No, you're absolutely right.
Okay.
The Omar Hassan al-Bashir, who declared jihad against the South also was the one who has been continuing the genocide in Darfur. Mm. But in addition to that, after the peace was signed, when South Sudan became an independent nation, a republic, last July 9th of 2011, after that, the North invaded the South, dropped bombs on Abyei, and even now, in the last 2 weeks, has dropped bombs on the South, which is an act of war. And you're quite right. Also, the genocide in Darfur continues. But also, since last June, President Bashir, there is a warrant out for his arrest from the International Criminal Court, also dropped bombs and continues, as we speak, on the people of the Nuba Mountains in southern Kordofan and also in the Blue Nile region.
Right. So this is where the phrase Nubians came from.
Yes.
These are the Nubians, and South Sudan is largely Black African. North Sudan is largely Arab,
yes.
and is waging a genocidal war against South Sudan.
Yes. Certainly did for over 23 years. And as a part of that, as you know, slavery was a tool of that genocide. It was government-sponsored slavery.
Yes.
And it was also a tool of ethnic cleansing. And as you and I are speaking, over 35,000 are still enslaved. And you've seen their mind-numbing suffering yourself. I'm sure when you were there and documented their release, you saw men, women, and children who had been blinded, the beatings, the brandings, amputations, horrific, horrific stories of forced Arabization, forced Islamization, but that didn't grant freedom. And so, of course, the concern is this nascent, fledgling nation, that it has a chance and an opportunity, because for 23 years, Bashir brought about this scorch-the-earth policy that he moved to Darfur and now moved to the people of the Nuba and also the Blue Nile region.
Right.
But 35,000 still enslaved.
In the north. 35,000 South Sudanese Black Africans being held by Arab Africans, Arabs in the north who are holding literally in slavery.
Yes.
Just like old-fashioned slavery. I mean, literally in slavery. And what is the international community doing about this?
Well, very little. That's what's so shocking. And I think if the Arab nations are very reluctant to do it, and the international community and the International Criminal Court, if they would put pressure to delegitimize the head of state, Omar Hassan al-Bashir, that might be a beginning, because after all, there is a warrant out for his arrest for war crimes and crimes against humanity. But there's been very little done. We've been very blessed in our country that legislation had been introduced, the Eradication of Slavery in Sudan Act, but it went belly up in the House Foreign Relations Committee in 2008, when the financial tsunami hit Wall Street and then Main Street. So there's very little that's being done, but there's this great turbocharged champion named Alan Ratner, and also you and your colleagues who've been there, who've seen that suffering with your own eyes.
Yes.
And of course, CSI continues with the help of men, women, and children too in this country, to bring people out of slavery, 1, 10, 15, 200 people at a time, by giving novidium, to secure their freedom, and the delivery of sacks of hope. So until the national and international community does something, Mr. Hartman, that's the only,
And yet Bashir was in a conference with Salva Kiir just recently.
Yes, and, you know, I think it's so difficult. I have such admiration for Salva Kiir because he was not provoked into war when the bombs were dropped on Abyei. He said, we will not go to war. Right. We're going to become an independent nation. It's quite a... It's quite a mark against Bashir by the Arab Union that he lost.
I agree, and I think Salva Kiir, in some ways, is sort of like General Eisenhower. You know, he had seen the horrors. He was a great warrior in that Civil War for decades, and he's seen the horrors of war. He's not going to do it again. Pastor Heidi McGinnis, Christian Solidarity International. Thank you so much for being with us. Great talking. We'll be back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back to Anything Goes Friday. Tom Hartman here with you. And Janet in Sharon, Pennsylvania. Hey, Janet, what's on your mind?
Not a lot, but I really do love your show. And I love it a lot.
Thank you.
I've really learned a lot by listening to your show. Most interesting thing I think that I learned so far was the happenings behind the Boston Tea Party.
Oh, yeah. It's one of my favorite topics. Is that what you called about, or was it something else?
No, what I really wanted to talk about was it's a question that I know the answer to, but I just want to know how you feel about it. What is the difference between a politician or a person that takes money from a lobbyist or a politician or another person that takes money from somebody that is given the money as bribery?
There's not much difference. Lobbying these days is a form of legalized bribery. The Center for American Progress, for example, reported that Big Pharma, the big drug companies...
Big Pharma.
You look at their return on investment, it's 77,500%.
Yeah.
So if they invest a dollar, they get $77,500 back, from their investment in politicians. I would like to do that with my 401k if I had one.
I would too.
So the answer, Sharon and Janet, excuse me, and thank you very much for calling and for raising the issue is that there's not much difference. It's a very, very thin It's like the ones who take their money via lobbying or via super PACs are doing it within the letter of the law that was largely written by the lobbyists themselves, and the ones who operate outside the law that was written by the lobbyists themselves that are stuffing, you know, money in their clothes or in their drawers or whatever, are just
or
not
their freezers.
Yeah, right. They're just not quite quite as smart, and or they don't have as good advice in their lawyers. Janet, thank you for the call. You put your finger on a huge problem. Fred in Wilmington, Vermont. Hey, Fred, what's up?
Hi, thanks for taking my call, Tom.
Yeah.
I have a grave concern with this Paul Ryan bill.
Sure.
And not that it'll pass, but I feel that he absolutely has to know the negative impacts that this is going to put on the American middle class. He must realize this. And with that said, and then you take the recent court decision that corporations are people, and you take the money that big corporations are spending on politics, and it's my belief that there's a definite movement going forward to try to take away the bargaining rights of the American people. And I mean, what do you think of that?
Oh, they're pretty upfront about it, actually. They, you know, first of all, they want to destroy unions. They want you and me and anybody else who's an individual who's dealing with an employer. Who may be dealing with a multi-billion-dollar corporation that has an army of lawyers and litigators and negotiators, and it's just you against them, right? And they say that's the right to contract. No, I don't think so. So they want to take away our right to unionize. And by the way, the union that I'm a member of, AFTER, just voted to merge with SAG, the Screen Actors Guild. So that's kind of cool. But in any case, they want to take away our right to unionize. And then secondly, yes, Paul Ryan wants to destroy the middle class. And is pretty upfront about it. I mean, basically what they say, their rationale is that, yes, there will be a bottom falling out. Yes, a lot of people will be hurt. This isn't, you know, I'm not quoting Paul Ryan specifically word for word, but certainly I've had enough of these think tank guys on who are providing them with the legislation who've right out, you know, in front of God and everybody on this program said it. You've probably heard it. Yes, the bottom will fall out. People will realize that they can't rely on the government anymore. They'll pick themselves up by their bootstraps, and the free market will suddenly blossom into being, and everything will become wonderful. And the fact of the matter is that, I think some of these people actually believe this bizarre Ayn Rand libertarian philosophy, but B, none of them can point to any country in the history, in the 7,000-year history of civilization, any country in the modern world or even the ancient world where it has been tried and worked. It is a fantasy. It's a Lord of the Flies fantasy. And so
a country has to work together as a unit to be strong and to be powerful.
Yes.
And you know, it's like I said, I'm sorry, so go ahead.
No, I was just going to say what you're describing is called society. It's we. And the individual and these individualists, they call themselves, or objectivists or libertarians, they will say there is no such thing as society. All there is an aggregation of individuals. This was almost a verbatim quote from Milton Friedman back in the 1950s.
Yeah.
And certainly something that Alan Greenspan believed. It was and is preached to this day by Paul Ryan and people like him.
Yeah.
There is no such thing as society. There's just a whole bunch of individuals. And if all those individuals follow their own self-interest well enough, then somehow society will just become marvelous. And really, in my opinion, what it does is it throws us into a predator state.
Yeah.
And you know, the people who are the most powerful predators end up eating everything else.
Well,
so,
that's just another hoax that they put out there.
Yeah, absolutely. Fred, thanks a lot for the call. Very well said. Mike in St. Louis, Missouri. Hey, Mike, what's up?
Hey, thanks for taking the call, Tom. I found you on Progressive Populist. Let's put a plug in for that fine publication.
That's great.
And then come to find out you're on Sirius Radio. Great. You are brilliant. And I love and mega dittos to you, dude.
Okay.
As a fellow left-leaning social, left tipped off the ledge socialist like yourself.
Okay.
I wanted to just a slight little comment on the, you said that the Republicans want to have deficits to kind of stimulate the economy. I think they want to have deficits because they want to create debt that the American middle class then has to pay back. It's just another tax on the middle class to pay
yes.
the federal debt.
No, I don't disagree with you at all. The reason that the Reagan ran up those huge deficits, the Bush the elder ran up huge deficits, and Bush the junior ran up larger deficits than any president in the history of the United States, and the reason why is because they could, right? Nobody screaming about the deficits because Democrats tend not to. And they were able to borrow that money in your and my name and spend it. Now, I would submit to you, though, that the reason that they actually wanted that debt, first of all, they wanted to do the spending, and they, back in the old days, they would have done it with taxes, but they wanted to do the spending to have a good economy that they could brag about, you know, to stimulate the economy. But they wanted to have the debt so that when Democrats came into office, which inevitably happens, we go back and forth, that when Democrats came into office, they could force Democrats to shoot Santa Claus. The Santa Claus of Social Security, the Santa Claus of Medicare, the Santa Claus of unemployment insurance.
This
is the two Santa Claus theory that Jude Winiski laid out back in the 1970s. You can Google it. I've written several articles about it. I've written about it in two of my books. It is, and they have been following this right to the. So yeah, I agree with you, Mike. I think it's well said. Thank you very much for calling and saying it. Jim in L.A., listening to SiriusXM. Hey, Jim, what's up?
Hey, Tom, the reason why I'm calling is because did you know that Joe Arpaio is actually committing a felony?
I understand that he is actually acting contrary to a court order. I don't recall the exact details of it. Which felony are you talking about?
Actually, in SB 1070, there's a law that states that if you are an employee and you hire, quote, illegals, you are committing a felony. And by not arresting the employers, the CEOs and president, like you were talking when you were talking to him the last time,
right,
he was actually committing a federal felony called misprision of felony, which could land him in jail, prison for three years and or a fine.
This is what they've been doing ever since Reagan. Reagan stopped arresting. You know, before Reagan, they would bust employers, and that's why the meatpacking industry and the construction industries were heavily unionized and they were great places to work. Reagan stopped busting employers and started busting workers, individuals. And you know, I've said ever since then, you know, we don't have an illegal immigration problem, we have an illegal employer problem. And if Arpaio is refusing to enforce the law, you're right. He is guilty of a crime. So Jim, thanks a lot for the call. Well said. 15 minutes past the hour. We'll be right back here on Anything Goes Friday on the Tom Hartman Program.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And check out our free app, the Tom Hartman app, for the iPhone and the iPad over at the App Store or at TomHartman.com. You can check it out. Anything Goes Friday. Welcome back. Gail in Boise, Idaho. Hey, Gail, what's up?
Hi.
How you doing?
Hello.
You are on the air.
I have a question on Alec.
Mm-hmm.
Is there some way or some site you can go to find out who attended, for example, the representatives in my state?
No. They at one time, Alec used to post their model legislation, and they may have posted who their members were. I'm not sure that they ever did that, though. But the easy way to find out is to simply call your local member of Congress, and they should have a local office, local phone number, or you can call the number in Congress. If you go to callcongress.org on your computer, there's a list of toll-free numbers. Call the switchboard, and just if you're not even sure who represents you, you can just tell them what your zip code is, and they'll tell you who your representative is and connect you with that office. And then just ask the very simple question, is Congressman or Congresswoman so-and-so, has this person ever attended an American Legislative Exchange Council, an ALEC meeting? And yes or no. I mean, it's a very simple yes or no question. And if they waffle or obfuscate or the odds are probably yes. And if it's no, you will hear an enthusiastic no. But ALEC targets, though, and this is what I was just talking about, was at the federal level. ALEC mostly targets state legislatures. So you'd need to call your state representative, your state senators. And what you'll find is that, and we had on, I'm trying to remember his name, he was a state representative from Wisconsin, had him on this program a few months ago. And he was a Democrat. And he went to the last ALEC meeting. He paid his $100 and he showed up. And he said that it was pretty much all Republicans. There were like a half a dozen, you know, kind of right-wing Democrats from very, very right-wing districts. But almost everybody else, of the hundreds and hundreds of people there, almost everybody else was Republicans. So you call the Democrats and ask them. They'll probably say, what's ALEC? But if you call, I would call the Republicans and, you know, who represent you in, at the state level there in Idaho and ask them and then let us know what happens, okay?
I will. Thank you so much.
Oh, and Jacob says alecexposed.com has some of that information. So you might find that, you might find that interesting. He says the Center for Media and Democracy. So thank you again,
and thank you for your program.
You're welcome. Thank you, Gail. I appreciate it. And thanks for watching Free Speech TV. Gene in Clarksville, Maryland. Hey, Gene, what's up?
Hey, Tom. This is Gene, first-time caller. I just wanted to talk about the same-sex marriage vote last month in Maryland.
Mm-hmm.
It passed. And
right. It was signed by the
advice.
Governor.
Yep. I took your advice and got involved. I not much, but I sent the my state senator an email. So he was strongly recommending he vote for it. And it passed, and he was the only Republican to vote for it. So yeah. I had a good feeling that, yeah, I may have had a little bit of, you know, I may have helped just a little bit with that.
I think you did.
Good.
That's great.
And I think all your listeners should do, just even the minimum would help.
Yeah, yeah. It doesn't take a lot of time or effort to make your representatives aware of your opinions. And, you know, that, and of course, there's a lot more that can be done, but that's wonderful. Good on you, Gene, and thanks for reminding us about another victory in the battle
good.
For civil rights here in the United States. Gene, I appreciate it. Great to hear from you, and thanks for listening to Sirius Satellite Radio. Martin in Seattle, listening on AM on Talk 1090. Martin, you want to disagree with me about Ahmadinejad?
Do I ever?
Okay.
But aside from that, listening to you as I have for, I don't know, 7-8 years. I practically never miss your program. So occasionally I have a right to differ.
Okay.
But regarding the filibuster,
mm-hmm.
that you were speaking of,
yeah.
I recall when I was a kid, and I'm pretty old fella,
mm-hmm.
I recall when I was a kid that filibusters were filibusters.
Yeah, I recall that too, and we had this conversation with Senator Sanders, 6 months ago or so, and mm-hmm. and he said, yeah, they were, but they weren't. You know, the Senate Majority Leader could have ended them or could have extended them, and it was still largely theater. And, you know, is under the Senate
yeah,
rules.
Yeah, of course it was. Of course it was. But I do recall that we did have actual.
I'd like to see the Senate rules amended to say that
yeah.
if you want to object to a piece of legislation and prevent there from being a cloture vote, a vote to end debate on it so that it can proceed to an actual vote on the floor, that you have to stand and speak. And when you stop speaking, if you stop speaking for more than X number of minutes, 3 minutes, 5 minutes, then, you know, your time is up, your filibuster yeah. is over, and it goes to a cloture vote.
Yeah, that's the way it used to be. And I recall the one who was speaking when he ran out of telephone books to read would yield to another member for a question or something.
Yeah, it was mostly the big one was in the 60s, and I think it was Strom Thurmond and
right.
And what was his name? Irvin? No, it wasn't Sam
yeah,
Irvin.
Yeah,
it was one of those. Was it?
Sam Irvin.
Okay.
Sam
Irvin. In any case, it was a couple of those guys who were old guys then and are long gone now. But
right.
Yeah, the old South. As it were. Anyhow,
well,
just 1 minute before the break, and you want to talk about Iran.
Yeah, but what I want to say is it takes more than a minute. You shot this woman down who said that Ahmadinejad said that Israel should be wiped off the map. You shot her down two ways. One, you said you dismiss Ahmadinejad. He's nothing. He's nothing. Well, he is.
No, he's not nothing. He's the president of the country, but it's not like the president of the United States. He doesn't have veto power over legislation. He doesn't have the power to introduce legislation. He doesn't have control over anything other than a bully pulpit, basically.
But he has something else. He has the Ayatollah, who has all of the power in Iran.
You're right.
You're right.
But he doesn't have them. They have him. And, in fact, they called him in 2 weeks ago and dressed him down. Did you read that in the news?
I understand. Yes, I understand that. But he says what the Ayatollah wants to be said.
Right.
Now, I have a moment to get on this wiped off the map?
No, Martin, we're going to have to do it another time. I'm sorry. We'll be back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
27 minutes past the hour. TomHartman.com. Drop into our free live chat room and say hi. I'm going to go there right now and say hi to everybody. Yeah, TGIF. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And John in Minneapolis, Minnesota. Hey, John, what's on your mind today?
Oh, I just have to say I wanted to extend what you said about the objectivists to, you know, their social philosophy, social economic philosophy, how it has played out in this century, in the past century. It's diametrically opposed to anything that resembles true Christianity. True Christianity believes in communion. That's why they go to communion. And so you have to be concerned about the social welfare of everyone and share and this kind of thing. And originally Christians, they were actual communists in the sense that they,
they lived communally.
Where they shared all of their goods. They didn't
yes.
have.
They, as St. Paul said, they shared their purse.
Right. And so anyone like yourself and Amy Goodman on the left, you know, people that are bringing up these issues are doing God's work. I just wanted to say that. It might make you blush, but I'm sorry. It needs to be said that, you know, this philosophy is just crushing us. It is so distorted, so unloving, so uncompassionate, and that's all I have to say because I'm sure you have plenty of other callers.
Well, I think you said it very well, John, and thank you very much. Jacob, maybe you can easily find that clip of Ayn Rand being interviewed by Morley Safer back in the 1950s. If you can quickly pull it up, that'd be great. And let me take a quick call here in the meantime. And Harry in St. Louis, Missouri, you wanted to disagree with me about judicial review.
No, Tom, I don't want to disagree with you. I need your help because I was using your philosophy about the Supreme Court and the Constitution, and somebody at the Huffington Post kind of knocked me right off my keister there.
Right.
They said that the judicial review is a power that allows the Supreme Court to decide whether acts or laws are unconstitutional, and they quoted they cited Article 3, Section 2 of the Constitution.
Right, which is what I'm citing. Where in Article 3, Section 2 of the Constitution, I'm hoping you have it in front of you. I can get it in front of me right now. Where does it say that the Supreme Court has the right to strike down laws?
What it says essentially is that they,
they have appellate jurisdiction as to law and fact.
The judicial power shall extend to all cases in law and equity arising under this Constitution, the laws of the United States and treaties made or which shall be made under the authority to all cases affecting ambassadors, etc.
Okay, before you continue with that, let me just establish for our listeners what the Article 3, Section 2 says is these are the powers that the Supreme Court has. First of all, they have a power that extends to all cases in law and equity. In other words, if somebody's convicted of violating a law or if you and I have a contract dispute, right? So that's law and equity, things that have to do with crimes or things that have to do with civil matters that have to do with money arising under this Constitution, right, which is the ultimate law of the land. The laws of the United States, laws passed by Congress, treaties made, treaties with other countries, or which shall be made under their authority. The Constitution grants the authority for treaties. And then it gives the specific responsibilities of the Supreme Court. They can all cases affecting ambassadors or other public ministers and consuls. In other words, if you want to sue an ambassador, you can't do it in a local court. It has to go right to the Supreme Court. To all cases of admiralty and maritime jurisdiction. A captain on the high seas is basically the emperor of his own little kingdom. So, again, if you want to go after him, it's got to go right to the Supreme Court. To controversies in which the United States shall be a party. In other words, if the United States government is being sued, the Supreme Court is the place where that lawsuit happens. To controversies between two or more states. So if it's between one state or another, in fact, between the states and citizens of another state. This was changed by the 11th Amendment slightly, by the way. Between citizens of different states. Between citizens of the same state claiming lands of grants of different states. In other words, if you say, hey, during Reconstruction, the Lincoln administration gave my railroad a whole bunch of land, you know, that kind of thing, or the citizens thereof. And again, this was changed by the 11th Amendment. And then you get, that's paragraph one. Paragraph two, in all cases affecting ambassadors, other public ministers, and consuls. I still haven't heard anything about striking down laws, right?
So if the Tea Party wants to sue the United States government to strike down Obamacare, does that come under this?
It's not here.
Article?
No, they could sue the administration. Well, actually, I don't see where they could even sue the administration. It continues, in all cases affecting ambassadors, other public ministers, and consuls, and those in which states shall be a party, the Supreme Court shall have original jurisdiction, which means the case actually has to start there. It can't start in a lower court. It starts right there at the Supreme Court. In all the other cases before mentioned, the Supreme Court shall have appellate jurisdiction. In other words, they're the place where the buck stops. Somebody has to, if you and I get into a dispute, which would be the equity part, you know, if I'm washing your car and I ding it up and you decide to sue me and I claim, you know, you gave me immunity and you want your $50 or whatever, and we go through local courts and state courts and federal courts, it's got to stop someplace. Somebody has to finally say, okay, you pay him, right? Or if it's you and me and Sheriff Joe Arpaio and he says we're violating the immigration laws because Jacob doesn't have his birth certificate with him, then, or, you know, whatever, then that court, that case has to end someplace, right? So, in other words, that's appellate jurisdiction. In all other cases before mentioned, the Supreme Court shall have appellate jurisdiction both as to law and to fact, with such exceptions and under such regulations as the Congress shall make. Nowhere there does it say that they can strike down laws. It says that they can decide cases based on the law. Now, they can have an opinion about what the law says, right? Somebody asked me this question on the Democratic Underground Board day before yesterday, and just today I got around to answering it, although it already scrolled off the front page. And they said, so are you saying that if a bunch of congressmen got together and passed a law saying we're bringing back slavery in the United States, and actually got a majority in Congress, and the Supreme Court came along and said, we think that's unconstitutional, that law should stand? And my answer was yes. First of all, it wouldn't happen. We're not that stupid. And that's why, you know, that's because I have faith in the people. I believe that if people, you know, if Congress and the check power, by the way, to Congress, there is a power to strike down unconstitutional laws in the Constitution. And it is in Article 2, and I don't have it highlighted here, so I'm not going to find it instantly, but you can find in Article 2, which is the executive branch, the president has veto power. And it takes two-thirds of Congress to override a presidential veto. So if the president thinks that Congress has passed an unconstitutional law, that's the check and balance against Congress going crazy. But the Supreme Court, as it does in Canada, as it does in Switzerland, as it does in the United Kingdom, I don't think should not have the power to strike down laws. They should have the power to say, we don't think this law is constitutional.
I don't either. This person at the blog took the wind out of my sails when they quoted this Article 3 section.
Well, I would just respond to them saying, I don't see the words strike down laws in there. Can you point them out to me, please?
Okay, yeah.
Nullify laws. Nullification is what we're talking about. The legal term is nullification. And is a law being nullified here? It's nowhere in Article 3.
All we need to do now is just do something about it.
Yeah, I'm with you on that. And oddly enough, you know who agrees with us? Jim DeMint and Newt Gingrich.
Yeah, I heard Newt Gingrich on your little audio clip. I listened to that a few days ago where you quoted Gingrich.
Yeah, I mean, of all things. The other person who agrees with us is Franklin Delano Roosevelt and Abraham Lincoln. So it's not like we're just in bad company. Okay?
Well, I don't want to take any more of your time, Tom. Thanks for straightening that out for me and everybody listening.
You're welcome. Thank you very much for raising it, Harry. I appreciate the call, and thanks for listening to us there or watching us there in Free Speech TV in St. Louis. Anne in St. Cloud, Minnesota. Hey, Anne, what's up?
Hi. I am the challenger to Michelle Bachmann that my sister called about last week.
Oh, really? You're a Democrat?
We were facing the NBC end of quarter deadline, and I wanted to call to thank your listeners for coming to my website and contributing.
That's great. May I ask a couple questions here? First of all, I'm assuming that you're not a Republican primary challenger, that you're a Democratic challenger.
I'm a Democratic challenger, but I have other opponents for the nomination.
Okay,
so there are two other gentlemen running.
So you're in a primary right now.
It's actually called an endorsement fight in Minnesota, and the endorsement convention
but it's
is April 14, and
functionally
a primary.
Primary
after that.
Okay. Well, our my official position, because I have put my foot in my mouth more than once and in primaries and learned not to do that because I don't live in your district and I don't know all the participants, is that I don't take positions on primaries, mm-hmm. but once the primary's over, you are welcome, if you win it, you're welcome to come on this program and really make a pitch. But if you want to put out your website right now and let people know who you are, they can check it out and make up their own minds. So go for it.
VoteNolan.org.
Nolan, N-O-L-A-N, VoteNolan.org.
Right. I did that so people don't have to remember how to spell Ann, because sometimes there's an E and sometimes they're not. I use the E, but I figure everyone knows how to spell vote.
Okay. Yep, you're right. So you are Ann Nolan.
Yes.
And you are running to defeat Michelle Bachmann. You're running for the Democratic Party opportunity to defeat Michelle Bachmann.
That is right.
I have to say, you know, again, I don't know anything about the primary or the people you're running against. They might be wonderful. But all three of you, anybody who is willing to stand up and run for political office, I say God bless you. You are braver than me. And I honor you. And thank you, Ann Nolan. VoteNolan.org. Thank you very much for calling in.
Thank you.
Good luck. And I appreciate the call. We'll be back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Back with more of Anything Goes Friday right after this.
I see trees of green, red roses too. I see them bloom for me and you. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world.
Hey, thanks so much to our show director, Louise Hartman, to my executive producer, Sean Taylor, to our associate producer, Jacob Dean, our video director, Jim Javinsky, our phone screeners, Paul Edney and Julie Lully, our writer-researcher, Sam Sachs, to Alva Goldbook for video production, to our webmasters, Nigel Peacock and Jamie Holly, our business manager, Ron Hartenbaum, everyone at the companies that syndicate this program, Dial Global on commercial radio stations across the country, Pacifica Radio Stations, Pacifica Radio Network on nonprofit stations around the country, Free Speech TV on Dish Network, Satellite TV, Direct TV, Satellite TV, all the cable networks who carry our show via Free Speech TV, Comcast, Manhattan Neighborhood Network, all the others around the country, Don Rojas and all the other great folks at Free Speech TV, and the folks at RTTV who work on the big picture, to our newsletter editor, Sue Nethercutt, to the folks in our chat room, to Ellen Ratner and Victoria Jones and all the great folks at Talk Radio News Service, to Jay Goodman Tamboli for our tech support, to our affiliates, our sponsors, and to you for supporting our program. Thank you. Sincerely. Pick up some of your calls here. Matthew in Austin, Texas. Hey, Matthew, what's up?
Hi. I was curious if you had heard about what was going on with the Michigan state legislature forcing laws into effect.
It's more the governor, but the legislature passed the law that authorizes it. The governor executes the law. Governor Rick Scott? Snyder. Snyder, yeah. Rick Snyder,
yeah.
Thank you.
Well, apparently they need a two-thirds majority for the law to take immediate effect, and they haven't had that.
I believe the law is already in effect because he's already replaced the city council of Benton Harbor. In fact, we had a councilman from Benton Harbor on this program 4 or 5 months ago when Rick Snyder kicked him out and replaced him with one of his crony buddies.
But in Michigan in general, as far as any laws that have been passed by the House, it's supposed to be a 90-day waiting period after the end of the session. But there's a provision in there with a two-thirds majority. It can take immediate effect.
Okay.
But they haven't had that two-thirds majority.
Right.
And
okay.
Apparently laws are passing with 63 of 110 to go into immediate effect.
Oh, that's interesting. So you're saying that the Michigan legislature is doing things that are illegal?
Yes.
Huh.
And apparently the Democrats in the legislature have recently brought a suit against them about it.
That's very interesting.
And some, some of the laws they passed recently by a court in the state had actually said, okay, these laws have to be on hold until we look into this further.
Right. I will have to myself look into that further, Matthew. I was unfamiliar with that. Thank you for the call, and thanks for the heads up. Walter in Chicago, listening to WCPT. Hey, Walter, what's up?
Hi, Tom. It's a pleasure to talk with you.
Thank you.
Hey, I wanted to talk about the Obamacare and why I think it's constitutional.
Mm-hmm.
There were some good questions that were raised during the arguments, especially by Kennedy, and I think I know the answer to them. The real question, and I'm borrowing from Norman Goldman here, as I see it, is whether you can immunize yourself from Commerce Clause authority by simply withholding yourself out of the marketplace or withdrawing from the marketplace.
Right.
And there's at least three important cases that indicate that you can't. And I'm going to go to perhaps the most unusual one, and that is the Heart of Atlanta Hotel versus the United States. This has to do with the Civil Rights Law of 1964, and the essence was whether someone can be forced to rent a room to an African-American against his will.
Right.
And if you think about it, what that person was really trying to do is he was trying to say, I cannot be regulated by the Congress because I am not part of the commerce in this transaction. I am choosing not to be part
now, for
of
the for
commerce.
The for our listeners who are totally confused right now, the Commerce Clause gives the power to the federal government to regulate commerce among and between the various states. And up until the 50s and 60s, it was largely interpreted as there actually has to be commerce between the states. Back in the 18th and 19th centuries, the individual states used to have tariffs and rules regarding commerce between the states. With the Civil Rights Act, the position that was taken by the Johnson administration and by the Supreme Court later was that if a lunch counter so much as had ketchup made in Pennsylvania, that they were engaged in interstate commerce and they therefore could not say to an African-American, you can't sit at this lunch counter.
Yes, in the particulars in that case, you had a hotel owner who actually solicited people coming from out of state. So the Commerce Clause was clearly established, but he
right.
said, Notwithstanding that fact, the Fifth Amendment, which doesn't permit you to seize my property, and the 13th Amendment, which does not permit you to enslave me, literally enslave me, do not permit you to force me to rent when I don't want to.
Right.
And really, that language that he used, that he was going to be enslaved if he was required to do this, is really the same idea as those people are now advocating that you cannot regulate inactivity.
Well, it's more the slippery slope argument that Scalia was making, that if they can force you to buy health insurance, they can force you to buy broccoli.
Yes. So I think there is a case where you clearly had a person who was forced to make transactions
sure.
against his will. Just as people who might have political objections to this mandate will be.
Well, there's no shortage of them,
and if
the Supreme Court has historically taken the position that a lunch counter that is within a state cannot discriminate against somebody within that state because they engage in interstate commerce by buying ketchup from Heinz Company in Pennsylvania, which was one of the cases, then mm-hmm. certainly. If you're buying health insurance or if you're getting health care and the tubes are made in Pennsylvania and the syringes are made in California and the drugs are made in Canada or Switzerland, I mean, that's interstate commerce. There's no way that you can walk into a doctor's office and find only 100% things made within the state in which you reside, for example. So, yeah, I'm totally with you. Walter, thank you for the call. And I'm sure Norman's all over this. He's a lawyer. He knows his stuff. We will be back on Monday. And, in fact, it should be an entertaining day. We're going to have a debate about the cult of anti-humanism with Dr. Robert Zubrin. And don't forget, democracy begins when you show up. Get out there, get active, tag. You're it. Have a great weekend.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to tomhartman.com.